Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Today is the World Day for the Eradication of Poverty. Sunday will be World Mission Sunday. Therefore, today's program travels to South Africa as Cardinal Wilfred Napier describes parish life in his country. Next, Ghanaian Cardinal Peter Turkson looks at what he likes to describe as reverse mission. Finally, we hear about how a courageous young woman doctor tried to tackle poverty in Calcutta. Lydia O'Kane now starts our world tour by reminding us of the Pope's message from today's general audience.
There were a number of archbishops who will now bear the title of cardinal. They are Archbishop Sean Brady of Armagh in Ireland, Archbishop Oswald Gracias of Bombay in India, Archbishop Daniel DiNardo of Galveston, Houston, and the Archbishop of Nairobi in Kenya, John Nuge, Archbishop Leonardo Sandri, Prefect of the Congregation for Oriental Churches, Archbishop Giovanni Laholo, President of the Pontifical Commission and the Governorate of Vatican City State, Archbishop Paul Joseph Cordes, President of the Pontifical Council, Cor Unum, Archbishop Angelo Camastri, Archpriest of the Vatican Basilica and Vicar General for the Vatican City State, Archbishop Stanislaw Rilko, President of the Pontifical Council for the Laity, and Archbishop Raphael Farina, Archivist and Librarian of the Holy Roman Church, Archbishop Agustin Garcia Gasco Vicente, Archbishop of Valencia in Spain, Archbishop of Barcelona, Luis Martinez Sistac, Archbishop of Paris in France, André Vantois, Archbishop Angelo Bagnasco of Genoa in Italy, Archbishop Theodore Adrian Sarr of Dakar, Senegal, Archbishop Francisco Robles Ortega, Archbishop of Monterrey, Archbishop Odilo Pedro Shearer, Archbishop of São Paulo in Brazil, His Beatitude Emmanuel III Delhi, Patriarch of Babylon for the Chaldeans, Archbishop Giovanni Coppa, Apostolic Nuncio, Archbishop Estanislao Esteban Carlic, Archbishop Emeritus of Parana in Argentina, Father Urbano Navarrete, former Rector of the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome, Father Umberto Betti, former Rector of the Lateran University of Rome. Pope Benedict also made mention of the fact that he would dearly like to have elevated Polish Bishop Ignacy Jez, but he sadly died on Tuesday.
Go to Mass anywhere in Africa, and on a Sunday or a special occasion, it is a colourful musical event. Drummers and other musicians practice for long periods before Mass begins, often out of doors, so that the arrival of the congregation becomes increasingly musical. After all, if there is an opportunity of singing, why not join in? If the choir is preparing for Mass outside the church, they and many non-choir members will find themselves dancing as they sing. After all, they are African, and God is praised with the whole body. It is almost impossible to sing and not dance.
Religion in South Africa tends to be a women and children's affair. So women's organizations tend to be the ones that are really the ones that make the biggest impact. So we've got the Sodality of the Sacred Heart. It's mainly women. The Sodality of St. Anne's is only women. CWL, also Catholic Women's League, also women. And those are the real drivers within the church.
Throughout Africa, parish life is vibrant and active. At its heart are the sodalities and the small Christian communities. It is easy to see at a glance to which group a person is linked because each has its own distinctive mode of dress or uniform. Cardinal Wilfred Napier of South Africa points out that the custom of wearing a uniform has both advantages and disadvantages. It is good to be able to publicly witness to one's religious belief, but at the same time, it is necessary to pay attention to all that is happening inside, in the heart.
The Third Order of St. Francis tends to be in isolated groups in South Africa rather than being the dominant group in any parish structure. But I think a lot of it has to do, of course, in South Africa, the fact that they wear the habit, and the habit makes them very, very outstanding, very much so. And I think many attempts have been made to say, look, it's the way of life. It's not wearing a habit that makes you a Franciscan. But you might as well be trying to turn the sea black instead of green or blue. It's just not going to happen. People want to manifest who they are. They want to say and declare what they are about. So we have quite a strong, in some dioceses, quite a strong presence of the Third Order. But I would say if you take the whole situation in the church in South Africa, you'll find that the greater part are the sodalities of the Sacred Heart, St. Anne's. For the children, it's the Children of Mary and various other sodalities for little ones. I think one of the characteristics of the African at this moment would also be you can't be something and not show what you are. So if you're a member of a sodality, you have to wear a uniform of some kind. And we've tried to say, look, the uniform isn't the most important thing. It's your faith. It's the way you commit yourself to Christ. But how do I show I'm committed unless I'm wearing a uniform? So you start working around in circles and with that kind of a thing.
The bishops have addressed the issue, trying to accommodate both people's desire to be visible witnesses of their faith and commitment, but also encouraging their need to search for a deeper relationship with God, even if it is unseen by the rest of the world.
I remember when a group of us were taken up to Zambia, bishops from South Africa, to visit the small Christian community structure that the church has adopted up there, because we were moving in that direction ourselves. And Bishop De Jong of Ndola was telling us how at one stage they had wanted to eliminate all kinds of sodalities, and the only form of getting together for the kinds of things that the sodalities are doing, praying, reflecting, caring for the sick and the needy, that would be done by the Chitanda, the small Christian communities. And he explained how this was accepted, and everyone was very happy with it. Then the bishops thought the next step now is to reduce the impact of the sodalities and put all the energy into the small Christian communities. And he says when the sodalities heard that this was happening, they went on a drive to recruit and to strengthen themselves to such an extent, the bishops soon realized we're up against it. So they put on their thinking caps and they said, let's, if we can't beat them, let's join them. So they issued an instruction. No one may join a sodality unless they can prove that they are active in a small Christian community. And it worked for both. So you had sodalities that were alive and active, and you also had the small Christian communities being strengthened by the numbers that came from the sodalities. Now, it's just some of those things that, you know, give you an idea that and one of the reasons they didn't want to drop being in the sodalities was the uniform. Very soon afterwards then, they found that, the bishops found, there's a lot of agitation for the small Christian communities to identify themselves by having a different uniform. St. Anne's would have this one, St. Clare, St. Francis would have a different one. And again, they said, we're up against it. If we fight this one head on, we're going to lose. So what they did was they said on every Sunday that a particular small Christian community is leading the liturgy, then the women can wear a headdress of a particular of a uniform color or shape or whatever pattern, and the men could do something similar to show that they are on duty that thing. But the uniform had to be associated with an activity in the church in that particular instance.
And so the bishops came up with a uniquely African solution to a uniquely African concern. And if anybody has ever had the opportunity to experience the small Christian communities, they are truly one of Africa's greatest treasures. Imagine having the opportunity at an ordinary Sunday Mass to listen to music of this quality. Believe it or not, you have just heard a choir from a parish in Lusaka singing the hymn, God So Loved the World. In many African countries, the church is growing rapidly with an amazing vitality. Cardinal Peter Turkson of Ghana is visiting England this week, linking his visit to the celebration of World Mission Sunday on the 21st of October. The Cardinal is the first to recognise that the growth of the church in Africa and other areas of the world is because of the generosity of the older churches. He speaks of the work of the Pontifical Mission Societies, for which he is responsible.
Is that any exaggeration to say that in some dioceses and churches in Africa, part of Asia, it is the PMS support which enables them to actually undertake a lot of their projects that they need to undertake as a church?
Well, I know when I was in Zambia, I worked to set up the Catholic radio station in Lusaka. And what helped us to do that was funding from the PMS to buy a car, because we couldn't have got the radio done without a car. And also, I know when there was a tsunami, different representatives of the PMS, both from Britain and from America, went out to the tsunami areas to see what was needed and to do something
to support,
really practical.
Yeah. That's even a dramatic situation, but I'm talking about even simple, small situations like helping, like put up, you know, church structures, a place of worship in some rural areas, helping put the roofs on some structures that people worship and, you know, study in certain places, and helping develop like kindergartens and day nurseries and, you know, for children in some places who otherwise would be sitting probably on the trees and doing stuff like that. So the impact of the work of PMS is almost, you can describe it and find it in so very many ways, you know, realize the way they come to help local churches grow and be a church.
The Cardinal has long been aware of the dependence of his own native Ghana on the funding and support of the Pontifical Missions Societies.
But I, you know, I know how Ghana and other dioceses in Ghana have been beneficiaries of PMS, you know, support and help. Now that I know and that I'm aware of. For 7 years, I was the president of the Conference of Bishops in Ghana. So I know of a lot of the correspondence, you know, that have gone on between dioceses, bishops, and various PMS centers around the world, you know, for support and help. And I just know that a lot of dioceses are able to live, exist, and function as dioceses precisely because of the support that they receive annually from the PMS.
World Mission Sunday is a particular concern of Cardinal Turkson. After all, he will be giving several major talks highlighting the importance of this annual celebration. This year's theme for World Mission Sunday is All the Church for All the World. The Cardinal is adamant that mission is a two-way process. Whereas in the past the gospel message was taken out from Europe to the rest of the world, now Africa is able to exercise a reverse mission, sending its own missionaries to Europe.
The church in the south also has a role to play, that it can also be missionary. Not in the sense of, you know, making financial contributions, but in the sense of helping keep the faith alive in the West.
Yes, because if you take England, for instance, England and Wales, you've got so many people who are Afro-Caribbeans.
Yes.
And so have a culture and a tradition that is very different from the culture of their host country. And so it's very important that their priests from the countries from which they've come are able to come and bring those riches.
Yeah, that is true. But that will probably be one part of it.
New migrants come to Europe not to be assimilated, but to be integrated, retaining something of their own culture and using it to enrich their new environment.
I would imagine that the people from, the new migrants, as it were, the people from Africa, from the Caribbean, Latin America, and now even from Eastern Europe, who also begin to arrive here in England, these are coming some of them with a very strong tradition of Catholicism. And speaking as an outsider myself, I imagine that when they get here, they have to learn to integrate. And I use the word cancer because I want to oppose that to assimilation. They're here not just to be assimilated, but to do a certain amount of integration. And that just means that they maintain something of their identity. And doing that, I think they come to enrich the host country. It's not just abandon, their own culture and their own, religious sense or Christianity and sense of worship and just coming to, take up something that is completely new, but they come maintaining something of their own past to also learn to integrate in their new environment, in their new home. And that way they come to enrich the church in Europe.
Finally, to India. Most of us associate Calcutta with Mother Teresa, but there were also those who worked with her to help the poor. Vidula Tower Diglintir now tells us about her mother. Charity has no timetable. Goodness is always found within a context. It is never in isolation. The name of Mother Teresa of Calcutta is on the lips of millions of people across the world. Yet her work only achieved its prominence because there were others who were also prepared to give of their time and energy to work for the poor and the destitute. Two of these people were a young doctor by the name of Urmila and her husband Vasant, also a doctor. Their daughter, Vidula Tower Diglintir, now married to an Italian and living in Rome, speaks of the situation in which her parents and Mother Teresa worked.
Actually, as a baby, I used to go there with my mother, who used to help Mother Teresa at that time. My mother was a doctor, a gynecologist. My mother and father, they both came to Calcutta in 1947, after partition. We were originally from the state of Indore, and after partition, my father decided to come to Calcutta. Since both were doctors, they decided to buy a small little nursing home or something and, start over a clinic or something and start working in Calcutta. But my father started working, but my mother thought that she should do some kind of social work. She thought that it was the, need of the hour. I mean, India was really bereft after, in independence and she really felt that I think the people had to put their hands together and create something, make India strong. I mean, that was, how it was. They were living a magical moment of sorts, They had got independence after a long, long struggle. So I was put into school, and over there in the school, they had a small group of nuns that started a kind of a club called Khairaberia, where they were helping destitute women. So initially, because I was at school, my mother had come there to pick me up, and then she realized that this was a good place, and we all went along with her to this place called Khairaberia, which was a center established by the Irish nuns, the Loreto nuns, to help destitute women and sort of to give them a chance to do something that could be then sold. And they would be able to earn something to keep themselves together virtually, because you know how it is in India in those days, even to some extent, perhaps even today. If you're thrown out of your family, or your husband dies, or you're, in any form, a destitute woman, nobody wants you, neither your family, neither your husband's family, neither society. So you have nowhere to turn to. And these were the women that initially, they wanted to give them some kind of succor, some kind of hope. So the only way they knew that if they were independent and had some money, perhaps it would have been easier for them to be able to face society. About that period, about the same period, about 51 or 50, I don't remember the dates actually, Mother Teresa had left Loreto College, where she was teaching, and she had come to Loreto in Tally, which is another Loreto, But it's not the very exclusive kind of a school. It was more for the poorer children. And it was established in an area that was extremely poor, where there were a lot of slums around, and Mother Teresa decided, no, I've got to help out here. I better do something here, because otherwise these poor children will have no chance. So that's how she started first the orphanage, first to look after the women who were, teach them hygiene. And then she started looking around to start mobile hospitals, small thing, where she could take they converted, I remember, a bus once, and they made it into a kind of a hospital, and they wanted to just go from village to village, teaching the women just simple hygiene. I mean, it seems a very big, today it seems nothing, but just simple hygiene, teaching the midwives just to wash their hands before delivery.
But just that saved so many lives.
That saved so many lives. Mothers didn't know that. Didn't know that hygiene could be a killer.
Because they want their best
for the children,
for their families.
Absolutely.
And sometimes it's only a tiny piece of information, like hygiene, that can save their lives.
Absolutely. My mother used to come back home, and we were, so by that time it was about 9 or 10 or whatever, and she'd say, you can't believe it, that these people have no idea how to clean, how to do the babies are born in atrocious situations, in gutters, and so, with this initial thing, my mother became very involved in doing whatever social work she could do. And then she went into the prisons, and there she realized the same problem, that the women would actually commit a theft or commit a crime just to go to prison, where they'd be safe from their families, from their husbands, from mother-in-laws.
And where they could eat.
Where they could do something. I mean, even though they were treated badly there, but at least their children could run around free in the park of the prison. And, I mean, it seems ridiculous. Most of these women were perfectly all right. There was nothing wrong. They had done one crime, but they were thrilled with that one crime because they were safe.
And it gave them dignity.
It gave them a lot of dignity. And then they started basket weaving in prisons. All the thing. My mother, along with a lot of other women of that time, of course, got a lot of these women to learn how to basket weave, to do embroidery, to do stitching, to make things. Again, they used the same Kairaberia principle to start a little shop for selling these items. And that's how, then we started to help these women in villages everywhere to be able to somehow or the other managed to make their own life. In fact, you won't believe it. I started years ago in the 70s a business of having a factory for making things. Exports from India was getting big at that time. And so, and my mother insisted. She said, why don't you do embroideries? Now, there was another problem. There were the Muslim women there who were very good with embroidery, but their husbands wouldn't let them out of the house. So she used to insist that, no, you go into the villages, take your piece of cloth there, give it to them, ask them to embroider for you. And after that, you go there and recollect it, give them the money. These women don't have to leave the house, but at least they'll have money that's their own. Spending means going to the bazaar or going to the village fair and buying even hair clips or some flowers or anything, a sari for themselves. But, they had that because the husbands wouldn't give them a single penny, and that was the main thing. But this gives them that little strength. I mean, I know if you look at India and you say, oh, my God, it's so big, there's so many problems. And everyone's trying to solve it. But my mother always said that if the country has given you so much in education, you must give back something. You really must give back something to the country. Do something.
Yeah, but what's the thing you remember most about Mother Teresa?
Personally, I remember her saying to me once, I realized she'd become very tiny. I'd seen her after a number of years. I said, you're so small. I didn't realize you were so small. And she says, important things are packed in tiny packages. So she said, remember that, always. she was a person I knew for ages and ages and ages. And, she saw us grow up, and she knew us. She knew my mother, my father. We were all part of the Calcutta scene of that time. We all were Calcutta. Calcutta at that time was a small group of people who were the educated, people who were socially conscious people. They were not many at that time.
But to be able to go out into the gutters and bring people who were absolutely destitute to somewhere where they could have some dignity, that would take a lot of hard work.
Of course it takes work, especially which what she did for the dying. That takes a lot of work. And I've seen her doing that. I've seen her clean them. I've seen her talk to them. I've seen her doing that.
Well, where did she get all the resources?
Oh, I presume that people, I mean, anyone would give her money. Why wouldn't you? I mean, and she didn't even know where it was coming from, where it was. She had no idea of money. She really had no idea. She had absolutely no idea. She just knew it was there, and she always thought that somehow God would provide. She really believed, and very, very, very deeply she believed. She always thought God would provide.
And she has left an enduring legacy in India. She's so much identified with India that it's almost difficult to remember that she wasn't actually an Indian.
She was Albanian. She was from Albania. Do you know, once she said that she actually had money and she actually started, did you know, I don't think you knew this. She gave money from the Missionaries of Charity in Albania to build mosques. And the Pope said to her, and this was her own story, she said, but why? Why do you want to build mosques over there? She said, because they were destroyed during the war, you know, in Albany. She said, but don't you think the people have to pray somewhere?
That's beautiful.
So, you know, that's what she was. As I said, you know, I mean, I can only tell you what I remember about her. And as I said, and I know so little about her. And these are the things I remember so clearly.
And your own parents, who did so much, what do you think was their legacy?
Well, I know that the only great legacy both my parents had to me, to us, was, you know, always give. My father used to say, you should be like a joss stick. He used to always tell me, like a joss stick. You should burn, but give perfume to others. And he always said that, remember that. So that, you can burn yourself, you can reduce to ashes, which you will be eventually. But at the same time, you've given a puff. It's like a rose, used to say. It lasts for one day, but look at the value it has. So that everything, you should be able to be in a position to give. The day you say you can give, forget about receiving. Receiving is not even if it doesn't come, it doesn't matter. But giving. And I think that is a very important, and that's about the only thing about my parents I've been able to always remember. And even today, whatever, I try and teach my children just that. Never be selfish. Never, never, never. Whenever you get a chance to give, even a smile. You don't know how important just a silly smile is. Everyone's nervous and warm, hysterical, traffic, etc. Just one smile, just one laugh. It's so little.
And so we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.